This is Bill Quine of Peel Heritage Trust, introducing this, our 16th recording disc. Wednesday, the 8th of September 2010, saw the Heritage Trust crowd into Peel Centenary Centre to listen to one of the most popular of the Manx clergy, Canon Brian Kelly. His chosen title was Rocks and Shifting Sands. This was to cover Brian's life in the ministry. Here we drop in as Brian has just started talking.
The Peel Beach Mission, no doubt this year, as every year, they would gather on the front, full of hope and smiling faces, and they'd sing their jolly songs about the man who built his house upon the rock, and another who built his house upon the sand. The rain came, the storm winds blew, one stood and the other collapsed. Rocks and Shifting Sands. I also took a walk through the cemetery, a good place to start anything, actually. The cemetery. And not for the first time, I realised there were people there, more often in fact, than I knew back in the town of Peel itself. In fact, there are more familiar names out there than there are here these days. The cemetery was there before them, and no doubt will be there sometime after them, and the same will be true of myself. But there again, we are reminded how we are creatures of the day, perhaps. We come and we go, and other things tend to remain. I've served in several churches, and churches tend to assert themselves by the very nature of their size, by and large. I mean, just have to look across the road as a starter. But even the smallest country church stands out because usually it's in a setting which is distinctive, and the style of building also sets it apart from the hen house next door, whatever the case may be. It's different. I started in St. George's Church, Douglas, because they needed a curate there, so the bishop of the day thought I'd be best employed filling a gap in St. George's. And thanks to Canon Percy Matthews of blessed memory, I made a start. Shortly after, the same bishop suggests I go to Foxdale and there to make my mistakes. I wasn't quite sure what he meant by that, but to go to make my mistakes. But above all, he said, I don't want to be bothered about it, so don't get in touch with me. So that advisor said, I hope somebody from Foxdale again. My apologies. I hope I didn't let you down. Yes. Then came the day when it was felt desirable in some quarters I should get some experience of an inner city church. So I went away to Bolton on Lancashire, and I still remember the night I had to meet the church wardens. And a very kind gentleman brought me into the church hall where I was to meet them. And doing so, he passed through the main part of the building, which was occupied by a Mother's Union choir, rehearsing some music for an event that was coming up. And as I walked through the hall, escorted by the secretary of the church council, the singing sort of faded and died down in the silence until we entered an annex through a door. By the time we got inside there, the singing sort of hesitantly began again in the hall. I thought, looking back, this is hardly the most auspicious beginning in another place. But I was young then, of course. In due course of time, the bishop, who was different by now, Gordon as it happened to be, urged that I should come back to the Isle of Man because, and Eddie will remember this, of course, very well, as many others will. It was the time when Foholu was very dominant. And the bishop felt that he should at least try to find another Manx-born clergy to join the staff, just for morale, really, more than anything else. And so I came back this time to Mackle. Just getting into the swing of things there, and I got to know Charlie Caruso very well indeed, as everybody seemed to have done in their day and age. That could be another story itself. But meanwhile, I got to know him very well, and just about then I got a phone call from Bishop Vernon Nichols, who said, would you come to Peel? He said, what for? Have you left something? No, he said. I think I'd be better employed going to Peel and do some work there. So I came to Peel, and there, of course, here I spent the better part of my ministry. and ran over my retirement date until eventually the Bishop Graham Note, and you may have seen on television at St. Paul's on the day, that's right, looking very well indeed, he suggested about time I took some time out and enjoyed some retirement. So since then I've been working for other churches and so on. doing things like that. But three on holiday at the moment, I was saying to a colleague over here, three on holiday at the moment, I'm doing something for each one of them in the next few days. So that's how life seems to treat me off and on. Meanwhile, back to where we were. So you don't mind me picking my notes to remind me what I'm talking about. Helping to do that. Don't be put off by all these papers. I shan't be reading all this through. But we're talking about the rocks and the shifting sands. The church stands, doesn't it? I mean, here there are at least two special anniversaries, both coming, or one coming, one just behind. Last year was the 130th anniversary of the day that the Archdeacon dug a hole in the field and a foundation stone was laid for the present Kirk German, as it was, and today St. Joan's Cathedral. 30 years ago, in November coming, next couple of months, 30 years anniversary since the church became the cathedral. That awakens memories of the day in particular. We did a strange calculation in order to accommodate as many people as possible for that service. Mistakenly, we thought 8 to a pew would be just about right. I don't know anybody here tried 8 to a pew. I was thankful when the service ended. Our ears are still ringing for some of the comments that were being made. Those had to sit on these or next best thing. At least they made new friends. Not necessarily with me, but with each other sitting around in the balcony. Well, now, yes, that was 30 years of the Cathedral of Life. And no doubt it will stand there for some time to come, despite the fact back in 1903 we had a particularly bad winter, which lifted the roof off the church, and that had, of course, to be rebuilt and restored to an entirely different type of timber construction. But there are a few photographs of what was there before, so you'll have to take my word for that. The shifting sands. In the year I was ordained, 1958, the first of the shifting sands seemed to make themselves felt. It was the year of the hymn explosion. You may not have heard of the Jazz Mass, but you may have heard of the late Ken McIntosh, who used to have a swing when you were getting older. In fact, he had a few seasons at the Bell Marina, I think. Yeah. He did. And he was invited to perform this musical setting of the church service, accompanied also by the Peter Knight singers, who are famous in their day, no relation to Sam. I don't think they're related to him, but anyway. Sadly, I don't have that recording any longer. One of the things about having to leave a vicarage such as that on Albany Road for something much smaller means downsizing and filling two skips in the process, and a great deal of material went out. And since we left the vicarage, since then and now, we've been trying to find things which we're sure we brought with us, but sadly not to be. The hymn explosion. Yes, the other day, a young man came to me and said, "Would you help me with my wedding?" And he said, "I'd like to sing the people to sing such and such and such and such. Could we have the modern tune to or Jesus I Have Promised?" The modern tune. That was written in 1960. That's 50 years ago now. Two generations before this young man decided to get married. or was a decision to get married. But yes, he called it the modern tune. Mind you, there's an old saying about the mills of God grind slow, and that this is very true, I think, of the church. I'm not thinking of this particular one behind, but the tradition of the Anglican church in all sorts of ways. Yes, it meant, therefore, all kinds of hymns are being written. Hymn books couldn't cope. They go through several editions regularly. In fact, the Church Times last week advertised yet another called Sing Praise, about to be published in the autumn of this year. The good folk at St. John's recently had United Service in the Marquee and a Charlton band. But again, they're willing to play for any occasion, by the way. So music of distinction, style and quality, we should try to match your highest ideals. But meanwhile, we were invited to accompany the singing. And believe it or not, we had to write out half the tunes because the band tune book didn't have them. Music doesn't stand still. It's constantly changing and moving forwards. BBC Songs of Praise has done a lot, I think, over the years to encourage new music. We've had them here in Peel. We had them at Kirk German in 1979. I spoke about seating people 8 to a pew. We didn't do it that time. But we had another problem altogether. Every ticket went in next no time at all. Every lady went to local hairdressers to be right for the television cameras. And then we found, when I came to the first rehearsal, that the company wanted to run a sort of tram line all the way down the south side aisle, along the tops of the pews, which took out, I forget how many seats, which all had been accounted for. Again, we're glad it was all over, but we had the programme director to go around and keep the peace as best he could. The second time it came to Peel a few years ago, it was rather interesting, because this time we went into the open air in the old cathedral grounds, St. Patrick's Isle. If you ever come across a recording of that, look closely at the beginning and the end. You'll see at the beginning, the tide was full in the harbour. By the time you see the end of the programme, the tide was out. That's perfectly true. It gives you some idea how long it takes just to put 40 minutes on air. But you know more about this, and television companies come along and do things. So there we are. So much for that particular setting where shifting sounds became very evident. Within 3 years of being ordained, the Bible had changed. The New English Bible had appeared. This was the result of the Second World War, and chaplains were found that the good folk in service had no idea of the scriptures, and if they did, it seemed foreign language to them. The time had come to change it. The 1944 Education Act in the UK meant that schools needed a standard text to follow for religious education. So the work began apace to produce the New English Bible. It was a remarkably successful. The story of the girl in the Clapham omnibus, I believe, became legendary. The very fact that shop girls were reading the New English Bible as they might read a novel on the way home from work all the way to work. And so 4 million was sold in that first year alone. The Bible was treated seriously, translators, and also the people concerned with the style, the literary quality, which has always been in some dispute. It's interesting that when it was revised again in 1989, one of the literary people on the panel was Philip Larkin, the late Philip Larkin, the poet of distinction. People like that could add their touch. But even so, of course, it doesn't compare, people would reckon, with the King James Bible. And often wondered, really, whether Shakespeare himself may have had some part in that. So you may have heard me remark on this fact that in the year that the King James Bible appeared, 1611, Shakespeare was 46 years old. And if you look at Psalm 46 in the King James Version and count 46 words in, you'll come across the word shake. And if you count 46 words from the end of Psalm 46, you'll find the word spear. I don't know whether this is an elaborate way to autograph something or not. It may just be fanciful, but it reigns with me until it has been established one way or the other. But think about it, and if you will have some idle moments, with people like you don't have, of course, we do have an idle moment. Pick up the King James Version. Ignore the stage director, Selah, S-E-L-A-H, that's for the chief musician. That has no part in the text at all. But count 46 in and 46 back, and see what you find. We move on. The New English Bible was compiled by scholars from all denominations, which reminds me of the fact that church and chapel have always been the great rivals, and certainly here in Peel there has been no exception whatever. Even today, if you have a joint effort, a coffee morning organised by one church or the other, there are those at one church or the other who count up who's come from the other church. How the balance swings. It's so important. I've been reading David Moore's book. I don't know if you've read I lost the type already. PR94. Anybody?
Fear not, family.
He talks about, amongst other things, the general election 1903, the election to the House of Keys. It was keenly contested by High Bailiff Lawton at the time. You weren't around.
No, I wasn't. No. I heard about it.
Yeah, And Tom Coddle, the blacksmith, who was a chapel man. But according to the book, extraordinary thing is, not only did he get the chapel votes to put them into the House of Keys, but, horror of horrors, the ranters joined with the Wesleyans to support him. No wonder he got in. Left the High Bailiff out in the cold. Yes, the late Bill Cubbon told me a story about this very place some years ago, many years ago. God bless him, he had many stories to tell, Bill Cubbon. He told me of how there was a time when the rainwater gutters along the roof here had to be redirected. So whenever it rained, the water from the Methodist Centenary Hall didn't go into Anglican drains just around the corner. He told me that quite solemnly. So I took it to heart. I don't know whether that still is true or not, but there it is. But times have changed. Times have changed. When I retired, Reverend Chris Belfield of the Methodist Church was on the spot before I'd even finished to say, can you come on to the plan? And I said, well, I'll help if I can anywhere, but you better keep me off sacramental service. That might not go down well. Why not, he said. Why not? So I couldn't answer that question. I well remember how I conducted Vivian Gaul, late Vivian Gaul's. Don't you remember Vivian Gaul?
Yeah,
good soul, wasn't she? Kind of soul. She worked with my Uncle Willie Neal in the coffee, in the grocery shop down there doing the coffee. But anyway, that's another story. But anyway, I was asked to take it in the chapel. I don't know what questions raised about it. Times have changed, and all to the good as well. When I was ordained in 1958, a report was produced, in the way of reports, solid things they are, very legalistic language. Reported proposals to bring together Anglican methods of closer unity, 1958. In 2002, they achieved something. They produced a watered-down edition. We almost made it in 1972, but sadly, in the General Synod of the Church of England, the votes fell short of the two-thirds majority, and though it was carried by a majority, simple majority, it had to fail. There it is. But again, time changed, and it took a pop festival in Douglas for another kind of covenant to be signed to encourage certain denominations to work much more closely together. I'll move on from there to the way we worship today. I remember the late Dr. Marshall Robinson. I'm sure many here remember Marshall Robinson with the scarf around his head up and down the street. Whenever I called to see him, he'd pour out whiskey into Tom, always like the grenade. But anyway, his acrobat should be properly and able to enjoy his hospitality. But he spoke about the days as a child he had to be seen and not heard in church. The holy hush had to dominate. Go to Patrick Church at the moment and you see a huge poster urging you to be beautiful for God. And then on the other side you see some balloons and some self-service coffee material not much further on. And just that alone reminds us, I think, of how things have changed in the way we worship. The language of worship has changed, of course, as you know, only too well. And we've reached a point now where it's hard to go into a church or a chapel and decide which denomination they, in fact, belong to. Admittedly, the old service book is still in use, I know that, but more and more we are using other material. So, the question is this all a great big gimmick to try to induce people to come into our churches? Because admittedly, of course, there was a time when the church or chapel was the centre of the social life of the community. But all of that changed. The Forsyth saga began back in the 60s. And since then, of course, all has different. And all kinds of things, alternative interests take place. But to me, it doesn't matter what you do to entice people. The only real question, the only basic question is, why bother to go to church at all? That's the only question. And that's the one which we answer our own way. Well now, The way we worship is determined by the Church's Parliament, the General Synod. It came to being in 1970, and I was privileged to be invited by the clergy of the island to represent them on the Synod for 10 years between 75 and 85. I thought, well, amongst other things, I should be able to get to the centre and tread the corridors of power, see where it leads me. Now, I don't know if you've been in the church house, possibly not, but it's very like the Villa Marina in Douglas, because you had this huge debating chamber which stood in for the House of Commons during the war when it was blitzed. You have this huge debating chamber, and round about it, the perimeter corridor, as I say, just like the Villa Marina. And you set off in any one direction, of course, and you pass all kinds of offices along the way until you end up exactly where you began. And you realise at that point you've not found any power anywhere. You've just met people, ordinary people, good people too. I heard many, many speeches by famous people in that 10-year period. What would intrigue me more than anything was the fact that they could be limited in the way I've not been limited so far. But 10 minutes to make your point. There was a traffic light system on the dais. Literally, so green, amber and red. For 9 minutes, your light is green. And then on the 10th minute, as it begins, it turns amber. Then when the red light comes on, the chairman taps the gavel and urges the speaker to finish in the phrase. If not, his microphone is switched on. It can be quite ruthless. Quite ruthless. That's perfectly true. And of course, the pomp and circumstance that accompanied the opening of the synod. The Queen attends, of course. And I remember one occasion how we all lined up in the cloisters of Westminster Abbey before entering the abbey itself. And diocese by diocese, we of course were the smallest, obviously. But in each case, a charming young lady from choir or whatever would be there with her placard to say who we were. And what cheered me more than anything, as you lined up rather nervously, was the sight of a milk bottle beside a door in the cloisters. So somebody was anxious to get their priorities right, make sure the coffee break was uninterrupted by anything else. And what cheered me up on the second place when we got into the abbey and this magnificent procession went down the centre aisle. The procession of cross got caught in a microphone wire. And I was so thankful because I knew it's not just across the road where we can get things wrong. Other places could do the same, and with great dignity and poise as well. So there we are. Yes, the synods, as I've hinted already, majorities have to be real majorities in other decisions are taken, such as the ordination of women ministers. This has been controversial, as we know, down the years. And yet, in fact, women have always been prominent in the church. They have been the backbone right down the ages. On Sunday last, I was in St. Catherine's Church in Port Erin taking a service, and St. Catherine obviously was very much performing with her famous or infamous wheel on which she suffered. And then, of course, you know, the other end of the island, Kirkbride, is dedicated to St. Bridget, another Celtic saint. So, Celtic saint, Catherine was not, but Bridget, yes, a Celtic saint. And all through the ages, people of that ilk have encouraged the church along its course. The interesting thing about the ordination of women is that some of those most opposed to it were quite happy to be appointed bishops during the time that Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister, on one hand, during the reign of our present monarch, on the other. Two ladies who played their part very powerfully in the life of the church. It had been rumoured, this is just rumour for anybody who writes notes, this is just rumour, that when Maine was submitted to the Prime Minister for honoured submission to the Queen of a proposed bishop, the tradition is that the first name is chosen. But sometimes it's known of a certain Prime Minister that they deliberately avoid the first name and go with the second. For which the church is countered by putting their preferred name second. I'm not to say which Prime Minister is more guilty than others. Couldn't say during Lady Thatcher's time that John Hapgood was made Archbishop of York and Robert Runciman became Archbishop of Canterbury. But both of those are very happy with the notion of women priests, so no problem there. We know, of course, here in this diocese that Noah Jones, his convictions, very much against that, and that's not to fault the man in any way at all, because the people of different convictions to this day, and will continue to be so. And we had a young lady from the south of the island, and she wouldn't mind me mentioning her name, Sue Watterson, who was due for ordination, having gone through Bishop Arthur Atwell's training course, and by our own bishop's invitation, another bishop from Carlisle was brought here to attend to the ordination of Sue Watterson. Just as Bishop Noel was asked again to go away to other places to ordain clergy who are not happy with women priests. So it goes on, and no doubt you have your views about that as well. It was a very significant date, incidentally, when the General Synod approved the motion for the ordination of women. It was the 11th of the 11th. Armistice Day, you might say, but in the year 1992. So we go on, rocks and shifting sands. Sadly and agonizingly, the question of divorce and remarriage came before the church as well. And these things had to be tackled. They had to be tackled. And part of the problem was that whatever view individual clergy and others had about these things, we had a day of our diocesan bishop. So there was a situation where, in London, for instance, the bishop of the day was very much opposed to the marriage of divorced parties, but across the Thames and Southwark, a totally different picture was presented. And so it came about that many couples north of the Thames who wanted to get married would cross the Thames and spend 3 weeks, perhaps, in the accommodation on the other side, so bands could be read and they could be married in due course. Of course, that is a travesty, we know that, of the truth. But the odd thing, and the interesting thing to this day, is this. But when Bishop Noel did leave after his time here in the island, after Easter in 2003, on the very day he set sail with Joyce, he received his last communication from the bishop's office, and there were guidelines on how to proceed with the marriage of divorced parties. I didn't tackle him any further about that, but I was quite happy just to accept the guidelines and proceed. There's never been a problem for me, and happily many of the couples I married during that period have survived. Should I say to the Bishop Arthur Atwell of the kind, who felt that it was alright with me, it's alright with him, so don't bother me any further. Those are the bishops I like. Why did you have no dislike in the Bishop Arthur Atwell? He had drive, he got results in a way that I know full well I couldn't have developed myself. So I thank God for all the bishops I've known down the years to the present time. But something much more desperate is happening now, and that is the question of sexuality in the church. I don't have to label that point, but it is splitting the church, the Anglican Communion certainly. East to west, north to south, the American church is in real trouble. And there are dioceses which want to be aligned with the South America or with Central Africa. The Archbishop of Canterbury went out to Uganda recently to urge them to be careful about legalising certain activities and allowing people to enjoy the freedom of consorting with, you know, within a circle of friendship which is meaningful to them. But it will take time. And sadly, we still have the situation in the Anglican Communion where the Lambeth Conference, where all the bishops come together in 2008, though those couldn't, and they formed their own breakaway company. GAFCON is called Global Anglican Future Conference. Still have to write these things down. Global Anglican Future Conference, which is very sad. And recently, a nominee for the Diocese of Southwark, Dr. Geoffrey John, was turned down. And by the very simple device of releasing his name beforehand. Apparently, if anybody's been considered for vacant bishopric, you do not release a name. Dr. Geoffrey John's name was released, and therefore he was automatically disqualified. By whom? I don't know. But there it is. This happens. What am I up to? Ministry. They're coming to changing times, talking about shifting sand. Changing times. There was a day and age, when in fact every parish had its own priest, which was a justification for the clergy turning up on Tynwald Hill on Tynwald Day. The incumbents only, the parish clergy only, have been traditionally summoned, not in a way, summoned there in the belief that they are capable of understanding the laws read out and can convey the point and meaning of them to their parishioners. That has changed now, and it is more formality than a necessity as far as the clergy attendance is concerned. I wonder what happens in the future, because we're coming to the state now, and here in the west of the islands, we're going to hear Eric Quirk and Peter Hillary Reader being appointed reader in charge of Patrick, and Cheryl Cousins being appointed reader in charge at Dorby. These are new developments entirely, which you have to live with. I was in St Mark's Church only a week or so ago, and there over the communion table is a magnificent window, and the dedication, much more interesting, dedicated to the memory of a certain Thomas Clark, who was for 36 years, chaplain of St Mark's. Just chaplain of St Mark's. In a way, it was a time when Dorby had its chaplain, and Luke's had his resident chaplain, in addition to St Mark's, and so forth. Those days, of course, had long gone. Thanks to the lay movement in the church, the elevation of the lay voice in the church as well. So in many ways, we seem to be approximating to the Methodist Church, and if for that reason alone, we might as well join with them anyway. Get on. I'm coming to the end. Use of buildings. This is something the present bishop is anxious about. He wants to see greater use being made of church buildings outside of times of worship. Places like Dorby are well placed because it was originally a school as well as a church, just like St Luke's Baldwin. So they have that as a social centre for many, many purposes. Not all churches can possibly do that. But even so, how else can we use them? Of course, we have concerts, exhibitions, films, plays. We've had Cluniac dances here in the cathedral, so much so that one gentleman who came over regularly on holiday said he's never coming again because there's too much jazz in the church, he said. So I was too late to point out to him that not long before that in St. Edmundsbury Cathedral, on I think it was two nights running, maybe wrong, you can correct me, two nights running, Radio 3, Wednesday afternoon Radio 3, St. Edmunds were doing called Evensong in traditional fashion. And Radio 2, the following night, they had a musical swing inside the cathedral, swing music. Back to Ken McIntosh all over again, I might say. But I remember after the Second World War, as communities were beginning to reform again, and people settled down once more, there were many endured purpose buildings to replace bombed-out churches. I only wish they had stayed as such, because that was purely temporary until such time a separate church hall could be built alongside or somewhere else. Whereas had they remained as one, they'd have spared all the expense and the trouble of today. But that, of course, is another story. So we find ourselves at the end of this, seeing that there has been, on the one hand, the rock, and on the other hand, the shifting sands. The rock, the faith we profess, and, of course, the people we meet all down the ages. And in all the different churches where I have served, people are still the same, scratch the surface, and you find underneath exactly what you find in the next parish. Not exception. I remember the time I knocked at the door in Bolton, and a gentleman came to the door in the singlet and long johns, and he I said, excuse me, he said, went back, came back to the door with a cap on. Many such things like that. And so forth. Yes, life goes on just the same. There is the rock, of course. Set me up on the rock that is higher than I. Rock of ages, cleft from me, all these symbols, of course. But throughout it all, we go through constant change, decade after decade. We have to be prepared for it, prepared to rise, to meet the challenge, and not just to overcome it, but to use it for the benefit of those we meet and serve. So thank you for listening to me, and over to you, Mr. Chairman.